Non-alcoholic? So a little something that my wife and I do in our spare time is we like to go yard selling. We like to hit thrift stores, look for, you know, bargains. And it's something that, you know, you pick up when you're hopelessly in debt when you get sober, and you kind of fall in love with it. And then and you hate paying retail, and you just, you know, you look for things. And one of the things we always do when we're at the Salvation Army or the Goodwill is we'll go to the book station and try to find AA-approved literature. And I always like to rescue big books that have been discarded, you know, and you bring them to your home group, you give them to book studies, and you donate them, you bring them into jails, you do whatever you can with them. And what I like to do is get a big book, and then what I like to do is open it up and start to judge a person that I've never met. And who's no longer in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll open the book, and usually there's a name and a sobriety date, and it's written in ink, which I always think is optimistic of us. I really do. And then I'll start going through the book, and I'll go through the prefaces, and I'll they underline that, good, 100 men and women, good. And, I'll go into a doctor's opinion, good, allergy, phenomenon of craving, they got that, good. A little note in the margin, good, twofold disease, good. And, Bill's story, and I'm watching that. And as I go through the book, I'm looking at their notes, I'm looking at their highlighting. And there's something I've noticed over the years, I've been doing this for a long time, is the book usually will be highlighted, notes, and I'm judging perfect. And usually, right after the fifth step, the rest of the book, not a mark in it. And, and I talked about desperation being the propellant that takes us through the steps, and that's a physical representation. I can look in somebody's big book that's now in Goodwill or the Salvation Army, and I can see the exact moment they ran out of their desperation when they stalled in the steps. And quite often, it's right after the fifth step. And why is that? And I think it's because of the emphasis we talk in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous so much about. We put so much emphasis on it, about doing our inventory and getting it done, that it leads somebody to believe that when they're done with it, they've completed something that they never have to look at again. And everything that we're going to examine this weekend is really the steps in the beginning. When we first go through them, are very compartmentalized. They feel compartmentalized. You ask any good newcomer, hey, what step are you on, kid? Step 3, sir. What step are you on? I'm on my ninth step. I'm about to do my ninth step. Somebody spot me. Oh, it's kind of heavy, It's a spiritual burn. But what happens is we go through the steps repeatedly as they're designed to be gone through. It's almost like the loving hand of God reaches down and starts pulling out the compartments that are between the steps. And what's revealed at the end of that process is what the big book refers to in three different spots as a design for living. How we're going to work out the solution to our life, these spiritual principles that we're going to put to play in our life. So I think it's very important when we're done with our fifth step that we don't delay. And so now we're going to look at steps 6 and 7. And I'm going to take things that I've acquired. And the first five steps are going to be very important as I go into step 6 and 7. One of the most important things is this principle of powerlessness. Now, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and in the first step I'm introduced that I'm powerless over alcohol, I don't have an argument with that. I have enough information that tells me I agree with that. But as I go through the steps in the second step, it tells me lack of power is my dilemma. And I look at the way I've lived my life and my inability to change anything about it, and I start to understand that this idea of powerlessness goes a lot further than just with my drinking. And then in the third step, when I realize that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my trouble, and it tells me I have to be rid of this selfishness, I muster, it kills me, it says there's no way of getting entirely rid of self without God's help, nor could I reduce it much, wishing on my own power. So I'm seeing that powerlessness again in the third step. I look at the fourth and the fifth step and all that information out there, and it's all bad news for me. But hopefully I've made that pivot, and now I'm willing to look at my life differently, my history differently. I'm beginning to see that the enemy lives in the mirror. But I can't do anything about it because I don't have the power. And so what I don't want to do when I go into 6 and 7 is fall victim to the old belief that this is my responsibility and my job. I don't have the power to do anything about my character defects. Yet I'm going to try. Because by this time in the process, unfortunately for a guy like me, my ego's been resurrected. And somehow, not from my sponsor telling me, not from the literature telling me, not from anybody in AA telling me, I think this is my job. So what I'm going to come up with is a list of character defects when I'm done with my fifth step. And if you're anything like me, you're going to be very specific. You might have 127 character defects. And you're going to get up in the morning, you're going to put on your hard hat and your boots, and you're going to go out in the world and you're going to keep an eye out for those 127 character defects. And you are going to be herding cats. And it is going to be exhausting. And I got to tell you, what I believe today is I don't have 127 character defects. I don't have 15 character defects. I don't have 5 character defects. I have 1 character defect. And from this 1 character defect, all manifestations in my life that I would label negative come from this 1 character defect, and one only. I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. You know, in Bill's story on page 13, Bill says, I ruthlessly faced my sins and had my newfound friend take them away root and branch. And when he talks about ruthlessly facing his sins, he's talking about steps 4 and 5. And when he says, I became willing, step 6, to have my newfound friend, talking about God, remove them root and branch. Once again, there's that word root. And then when we come down into the 7th step here, or the 6th step here, it says, can he take them all, every one? So we're looking once again at this idea of root that's showing up in a couple of places. It shows up on page 13 with Bill, and then on page 62 when it talks about the root of our trouble. And for me, that's a visualization. I start thinking about my character defects. I start thinking about my character defects like a very large plant. Now, you can look at this plant, and what you're going to see is this. You're going to see a big stalk coming up out of the ground. And then a couple of feet off the ground, it's going to start branching out. There's going to be branches going out in every direction. And on these branches, it's going to be heavily leafed. There's going to be leaves, and then there's going to be buds, and there's going to be flowers. There might even be some fruit on this stuff. And there's going to be a lot going on with this. And I look at that as my character defects. Now, what I have is a couple of choices. Now, I can get out my spiritual pruning shears, and I can think this is my job. And I can go around for the rest of my sobriety, and I can start trimming these things off. Oh, I was selfish today. Oh, I was in judgment of others today. Well, I was lustful today. Oh, I was really inconsiderate today. I missed an opportunity to be helpful today. And I can walk around, and I can trim and trim and prune and prune and prune. In fact, I could get so disgusted with this bush of my character defects that I'll finally say, that's enough. I can't even take this anymore, and I'll get an axe out. And I'll chop off the stalk, and it'll fall over, and I'll haul away. I'll throw it in the back of my truck. I'll take it down to the dump, and I'll get rid of it. And I'll go back, and I'll go, oh, I'm glad that's great. But I've done nothing about the root. And I'll turn my back for a couple of months, and I'll turn around, and that damn bush is there again. Grown up with all the branches, all the leaves, all the fruit, all the buds. I'll go, what happened? I took it down to the ground, but that's not where the problem lies. In Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, alcohol is but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and conditions. When we're talking about cause and condition, we're talking about the root of the trouble. We're talking about what's underground, what we can't see, what's not easily apparent to a casual observer. Because to be free of these things, I have to go underground. I have to get to the root of the trouble. I have to get to the selfishness and self-centeredness. And here's where it gets more problematic. I don't have the power to do anything about it. But that doesn't stop me. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to get up in the morning, I'm going to pray to God, I'm going to meditate, and this is what I'm going to say to myself. Go out there, Don, and don't be so damn selfish. And I'm going to think about how I look, why I think about myself not being selfish, and I'm going to think some more about myself and how you think about me as I'm not being selfish. And I'm not going to be selfish, and I'm going to do these things and hope that you notice that I'm not being selfish. Did you notice? And if you don't notice that I'm not being selfish, I might get a resentment. Oh, I got a resentment. I must be in self. So then I'm going to try to get rid of that self, and I'm going to call my sponsor, and I'm going to write an inventory. And what I'm doing is I'm working on myself. And it's not my job anymore. I think one of the reasons there's only 2 paragraphs, because the question is begged. Really, here's the question that should be. Is that really all there is to it? What if the answer is yes? What if we're going to have very little to do with the solution because the needed power isn't there? Am I going to spend the rest of my life deciding that fixing myself is now my first order of business? Or am I going to find that the inventory process that we discussed, there's a fine line between self-examination and self-obsession. Am I going to cross the line where I'm doing enough self-examination to find out the truth about the stock and trade? Or am I going to go into self-obsession, where I'm so concerned about how I'm feeling, how I'm acting, how the world's going, how you're reacting to me, that I'm no earthly good. And I've dressed it up in spiritual language and spiritual clothing, but now I'm running through Alcoholics Anonymous, obsessed with myself and how I'm feeling and how you perceive me, and am I getting well fast enough? And I think AA is a matter of subtraction rather than addition. I don't think there's anything wrong with me. I think I was born exactly the way God wanted me to be born. I think what's happened is I've acquired a lot of things that I thought I needed, that I had to make it in this world, and a lot of this stuff has to be discarded, and I don't have the power to get rid of it. I put a lot of effort into working on my character defects, and I made absolutely no progress at all. I remember when I started dating my wife, Eileen, who's, you know, coming up on 26 years sober, a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I met Eileen, and it was interesting, Eileen is the first woman I've ever asked out on a date, which is weird because I've been engaged twice before I met her. I've lived with a bunch of different women. But I thought about it, I never actually asked anybody out on a date because you don't date like that when you're an alcoholic. You know what I mean? You're at the bar. You look across the room and she's drinking. You look at her and she looks at you and you know. And next thing you know, you're renting a U-Haul. That's just how it happens. And but I met her in AA, you know, and I had sponsor direction that I don't pull any moves without talking to my sponsor about it. So I came to him and asked him about this girl, and he knew her, and he said, "Oh, she's a good egg. You should ask her out." One of the hardest things I ever did in my life. I remember I called her up. We talked for 45 minutes about everything except going out. Never brought that up. And as we were getting off the phone, I said, "Do you think maybe perhaps sometime in the future, no pressure, you don't have to say yes or no, you don't have to do this now. I know you're really busy and probably have a full plate, but thought maybe we'd go out to dinner or something sometime." She said, "I'd love to go out to dinner." And I was hyperventilating. I got, "Okay, bye." And I just didn't make any plans, didn't set a date. I said, "Okay," click. So we start dating and it's hard. I mean, it is ridiculously hard. And I didn't realize this, that one of the reasons I would have never said that I was obsessive in relationships is whiskey kept me from being obsessive. It kept me from caring. If I didn't like the way I felt, I just got drunk. You weren't really real to me. You weren't really there. I never had to really deal with my feelings. Now I'm sober and I start dating this woman. I fell in love with her. I mean, I fell for her like a rock off the side of a boat to the bottom of the lake. I mean, it was brutal and I didn't like it. I mean, I went out with Eileen for a couple of months and I called my sponsor up and I said, well, I called him up and asked him if I could come over and talk about my relationship, because sponsors like that. They enjoy that when you say, "Can I come over and talk about my relationship?" They say, "Sure, let me get my pistol out, I'll start cleaning it." You start talking, they go ahead, you talk. Yeah. And so I told him I wanted to break up with Eileen. And he said, a very obvious question, he said, "Well, why?" He goes, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Oh, nothing, she's perfect." And he goes, "Well, why would you break up with her if she's perfect?" And I said, "Oh, I can't handle it. I'm just completely obsessed. I don't like the way it makes me feel. I like it when they're into me, not when I'm into them. This isn't working for me at all." And he called me a bad name, and he gave me direction that I couldn't break up with my girlfriend. And I said, "You can't tell me I can't break up with my girlfriend." He said, "Well, I just did." So June 30th of this year, we'll celebrate 21 years of marriage. Shows you how much I know about my life. Now, yeah. But here's me working on my character defects. So one night, we both knew each other's meeting schedules. And we weren't living together, and we went to different meetings, and we would call each other at the end of the night to check in. And I knew she was at this meeting that ended at 9:30. And she's got a cleanup commitment. She'll be done by 9:45. Then maybe she'll talk to some of her friends. It'll be 10 o'clock. She lives about 15 minutes away. She'll be home by 10:15, 10:30 at the latest. She'll probably call me around 10:30 and say goodnight. No big deal. 10:15, I'm looking at the phone. "Oh, Eileen should be calling soon." No big deal. And I'm really lucky to have a woman like that in my life. God, I love her. 10:30 comes. I know she's going to call any minute. I go, I'm so excited. So, you know, I got so much to tell her. And God, you know, thank you, God, for putting Eileen in my life. You know, I'm just so lucky to have her. And 10:45 comes by, I'm a little concerned. Well, God, I hope she's okay. I hope she didn't get in a fender bender or nothing. No, she's probably talking to a newcomer or something like that, probably doing something spiritual. thank you, God, for putting Eileen in my life. I love her so much, you know. About 11 o'clock, she hasn't called yet. I'm like, you know what? She never loved me. And, by 11:15, I'm like, you know what? I don't need to be with someone that treats me this disrespectfully. I think it's over. At 11:30, when my phone rings, I don't answer it. Not that I'll arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness. And I let it ring and ring and ring, and then it goes to the answering machine, which we used to have back in the day. And after my little entry message, I hear her say, "Hi, honey, it's me. I'm sorry I'm calling so late. I had to give this newcomer a ride home. She was really struggling. We sat in front of her house talking for like 45 minutes. I just wanted you to know I had a good day, and I missed you desperately, and I love you so much. Can't wait to talk to you tomorrow." Click. Ah. What the hell is wrong with me? I'm filled with guilt and shame and remorse. And I go to God and I ask his forgiveness and I tell myself. And I get an idea of what I'm going to do next time. And next time when this happens, I'm going to do this. And next time when this happens, I'm going to do that. And the next time it happens, what do? I'm sitting there at 11:30 staring at the phone, letting it ring, hating her, going to break up with her. Because I can't do anything about my character defects. I can't do anything about my jealousy. I can't do anything about my obsession. I can't do anything about my judgment. I can't do anything about my head. I don't have the power to do anything about it. But it doesn't stop me from trying, and I'm getting slaughtered out there. And I'm not making any headway, and I'm thinking maybe AA doesn't work for a guy like me because I'm getting worse. I'm not getting better in certain areas of my life. I'm 6. I'm 7 years sober. I'm still angry. I'm still the short fuse guy. I'm still the guy that I got to put my hands in my pockets and grip my teeth because I'm afraid I'm going to put my hands on somebody. I'm still the guy that wants to chase you down in traffic. I'm still playing that tough guy stuff. I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't want to be that guy. I know it's not the way that God wants me to live, and I'm working on it. Don't you know how much I don't want to live like this? I'm 8 years sober, and I'm staring at the mirror at 11 o'clock at night, and I'm looking in the mirror, and I say out loud alone in my bathroom, "I'm so tired of being you." And what do you do when you hit that point, that surrender in Alcoholics Anonymous? And what happened for me is I had to reexamine steps 6 and 7. And I had to look at what I was doing with that work. And what I went to my sponsor with, and I said, "I'm working so hard on 6 and 7. I'm doing everything I can. I'm aware of my character defects. I'm looking for them on a daily basis. I'm finding them all over the place. And I'm telling myself what I would do instead if the opportunity represented itself. What, if anything, would I do differently? And I have an idea what I'm going to do differently. And the world and the people in it hold up those emotional hoops, and I'm off my feet and halfway through the hoop, and I don't even know I've jumped. I'm a reactor. And I don't want to be a reactor. I'm moving at this pace that's not compatible with life." And my sponsor said, "That's your problem. Because you're moving at Don's pace instead of God's pace. There's a speed to God's will, and you're not in it. The speed you're moving is much too fast. Don's will is reactive. God's will is contemplative. You don't have any room for thought. You don't have any room to really commune with God. And that's because you're working on your character defects, and it's not your job anymore." Now, I've heard a lot of people talk about character defects, and this is my experience with them. I was putting my effort in the wrong place in step 6 and 7. And I think Sheldon really did a wonderful job about talking about step 6. The whole program might be about step 6. Because if you ask somebody, what is the whole program of Alcoholics Anonymous about? If they're answering accurately, they will say, its whole intent is that you can have a conscious contact with a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. This is a God program. Yet I'm using self-will to try to take on my character defects and confuse that I'm not making any headway on them. And what I stopped doing is I stopped trying to fix myself, and I stopped putting energy in, any energy at all, on working on my character defects. And I redirected my energy into one area and one area only, working on my conscious contact with a power greater than myself. You see, I'm the guy that does prayer and meditation, and I get up so spiritual when I'm done with that, I don't even need a truck to get to work. I could float there. But there seems to be a spiritual guillotine that hangs at my front door, and as I'm going out the front door, it drops and severs my conscious contact. And I run on self-will all day, and I do what I do, and I get what I get, and then I go to the meeting at night and tell you how wonderful AA is, how much I love God. And then I sit there and reflect on my day in the 10th and the 11th step at night, and I wonder what the hell happened and where was God all day. Well, I left him at home. I left him in that room where I read that spiritual literature. I left him next to my bed where I get on my knees, but I didn't realize my life's not lived reading spiritual literature in my sunroom or on my knees next to my bed. I've never gotten in a great deal of trouble there. That's really not where I need God. I need him out there where I live my life. I started working on that conscious contact with God, and I want to talk about spirit. You know, there's an important thing after the third step in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous after Bill wrote out the third step. And then he says that we should probably do this with an understanding friend, but it's better to meet God alone with someone that might misunderstand. But then he says something I think is a spiritual direction, and it's about all the prayers in the Big Book, and I think it applies to the third step as well as the seventh step or any other prayers in the book. Bill says this, the wording was, of course, quite optional, as long as the idea was expressed without reservation. He's talking about the third step. And I think that's the same thing with the seventh step. And I'm telling you, when I simply live in the spirit of the third step and the seventh step, and what is the spirit of the third step and the seventh step? What words would I use, my own words, for the third step and the seventh step? What would it sound like? You know, Dad, I'm home. God, I've been gone a long time. I turned my back on you, and I got to tell you, if I ever needed you, I'd need you now. Because I've made a mess of my life, and I don't know what to do. And I'm offering myself to you, and you can do whatever you want with me, because I've made a mess of it. I don't know what to do. I don't know if there's even anything worth reclaiming here, but whatever I got, you have, good and bad, do what you want with it, because I'm so tired of running the show. And I've been living in that bondage of self in my mind. I just can't be free of it. I'm so tired of thinking about myself. I'm so tired of how I feel being the most important thing in the universe, and I can't seem to stop doing that. And if you took that away from me and you gave me strength, your strength, not my strength, give me your strength, I'll go out and not only will I serve you, I'll serve your kids. And if you did that for me, Dad, I swear I'd never take credit for it. I'd spend the rest of my life telling people what you did for me. What happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous through your love, your power, your kindness. I'll tell them what happened to me, Dad, but I need your help, and I need it today. When I have that kind of humility in my life, and I remember who I was when I got here and who I am today, then what I can do is I can go out in the world, and I can live in the spirit of the third step and the seventh step. And when I'm in the spirit of the third step and the seventh step, for that moment are moments, my character defects are instantaneously removed. Now, does this mean that when I don't have a conscious contact with God, I'm automatically slammed back into communion with my character defects? No. It just means the door's open. It just means that now there's a possibility of me in acting in a way that we like to call around here old behavior. And of course, we all know that if we're still participating in it, it ain't old behavior anymore. It's current behavior. But my experience has been, when I am simply living my life as I think God would have me live it, I don't even know if I'm accurate. I'm just trying to live my life the way I think he would have me live it, trying to act in that manner, think in that manner, be helpful in that manner. In those moments or moment that I am truly consciously connected to my Creator with my heart and my mind attuned to the welfare of others and not self, in those beautiful, brief moments of my day, I am free, and my character defects are instantaneously removed. They cannot draw a clean breath. So for me, the object, the goal, the task of my daily living is not to improve on my character defects. It's to improve the time that I spend with God, to fill in the blanks between morning and evening prayer and meditation, the bookends of spirituality. Can I fill in those and arrive at something that we call in Alcoholics Anonymous a conscious contact? I'm awake and I'm connected with a power greater than myself. Because when you look back, at least when I look back at my history and I look at those things in sobriety that I go, God, I can't believe I did that, said that, felt that. There's always something present in that remorse, the absence of a conscious contact. And when I look at some of the things I'm the most joyous about, when I really see the gifts of my life and the things that have happened, there's always something present in that picture, in those feelings. And that's evidence of a conscious contact at that moment. So rather than work on my character defects, I remember that I'm going to ask my newfound friend to take them away, root and branch, that God's going to be the one that's going to go underneath, and he's going to get to the root of the problem. But what I know about my character defects is they will be removed by God instantaneously, but anything removed can be returned. And all I have to do, what environment do I have to create for my character defects to be returned, to come out and play, to be let off the leash, is something more, nothing more or less than running on self-will. A friend of mine says this perfectly. I love this. He says, you know, I'll get off the beam and I'll run on self-will. And next thing I know, I'm in collision with everybody or everything. And I'm stepping on the toes of my fellows and they're retaliating. And I think without provocation, because I'm an extreme example of self-will run riot, and I don't think so. And I'll finally slow down enough to go, what the hell is wrong with me? And I'll realize it's my prayer and meditation. I'm giving it lip service. I'm not really into it. So you know what? I'll make a commitment. I'll get up early. And you know what? I'm really doing my prayer and I'm really doing my meditation. And as I go out the door, I'm lined up with God. And I spend the whole day playing that spiritual game. Everything that happens is exactly what's supposed to be happening. And my job is to help whoever's in front of me. And I'll do that for 3-4 days in a row. And I got to tell you, it makes me feel so good, I'll stop doing it. Let's take lunch.